Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies, we'll reach in there, we'll pull the baby out, clip the cord, but not in a creepy way.
Oh, no. That's creepy just hearing it.
Awkward.
There you go.
Sure.
All right. Well, welcome. This is Eric.
Sure.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1987 Scott Glenn movie Man on Fire.
Wait.
Okay. No, we're going to talk about the 2004 Tony Scott directed movie Man on Fire, starring Denzel Washington.
Did you even try to locate the Scott Glenn version?
No, I just looked at it a great deal. I didn't try to find it to watch it. I was shocked that it existed.
I'd be mildly interested. Like, if it was on TV, I'd probably watch it for a while.
Exactly, yeah. I'm not interested enough to actually sit through it, though, I don't think. Like, go out and find it and sit through it.
Maybe. I like Scott Glenn.
Yeah. It's got some actually other good cast members, too. We can get to there when we get to there. But so, any housekeeping first?
Yeah, it's funny. We didn't get to record a podcast last week, cause my wife, went out of town, on short notice. So I was left with two little ones to watch after. I had, a music topic to talk to you about. And it's funny because in the interim, I listened to the podcast with you and Jason where you talked mostly about music, which was awesome. Maybe my favorite podcast so far.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you liked it. It was fun to do. You and I should do it.
Yeah. But what I wanted to talk to you about was, for some reason, I recorded the Doors live at the Hollywood Bowl, their 1968 concert.
Wow.
On Palladium. And, cause I like having, music on in the background when we're just kind of playing with the kids in the living room. Cause that way, you know, the TV's on, which is comforting to me, but nobody's really watching it and I don't have to be paying attention to whatever's on. So I thought, oh, the Doors. That's cool. I can, you know, start exposing the girls to the Doors because I really like the Doors. You got me hooked on the Doors at a very young age.
Oh, the Doors are great. The live version of the Doors may not be suitable for children.
No, as it turns out, but they were already off to bed by the time any of that stuff got started. Yeah, I was really struck by how Jim Morrison looked, because I have not really listened to the Doors much in years, but I did listen to them a lot when I was starting. 13, 14, mostly through high school. I listened to them a lot. And back then, you know, Jim Morrison seemed, older and wise and kind of mystical. But what really struck me looking at this concert now at my advanced age of late 30s, he was just a kid. I mean, he looks so young in that concert. It really kind of threw me for a loop. He's just so incredibly young.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally a kid. And not the kind of kid as older people that we are now would want to ever hang out with.
No.
It's like pretentious poetry writing jackwagon kid.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but as a young teen, it's like, wow, this guy is some sort of god.
It really knocked me for a loop.
Was he mostly sober? I mean, is it a good concert?
Yeah, it was a good concert.
Oh, that's cool. Because there are ones that exist where he is not sober, and it's not very good.
No, it was pretty good. Excellent. How about organ music?
Well, you know, that's the other thing. It's funny because you listen to people who, Like, I just grew up thinking, well, of course, the Doors are awesome. You know, it'd be like saying, like, if there's any controversy about Jimi Hendrix being a good guitarist. Like, there is no controversy. Like, the Doors are good. Well, a lot of people are not impressed by the Doors, it turns out. Because it's, you know, on one hand, you've got Jim Morrison, who evidently, if you don't like him, you really don't like him. And then you have Ray Manzarek, who is doing all these keyboard noodly fiddly things during all of these songs. And they suggest that he is chock full of musical pretension. But that's what I like about all those Doors songs. Like, An American Prayer, that album, is so great. Because it just runs so seamlessly through the whole catalog. And actually, I think it was either a Fresh Air interview, or maybe even like a Charlie Rose interview, where Ray Manzarek is interviewed but while he's sitting at a piano, and he's explaining how he came up with certain songs. And it's fascinating. I mean, since I'm not a musician, I don't understand the process of that, but it was fun to watch him break it down.
Have I told you about the There Will Be Spoilers podcast about music?
No.
So there's it's a dude, I think he's on like the Adam Carolla network of podcasts. But he has a movie, discussion. I don't even know if it's a movie review. I've only listened to one episode and it wasn't about movies, but the podcast is, There Will Be Spoilers. But he had, like a high school buddy of his on who is, was like this, he's this musician, so he's kind of like a musical prodigy. And he brought him on and they had a discussion of, when stupid pop songs are actually smart. And they went into like a really technical, music theory discussion on, how music, how it's composed, how it can affect the way you feel, you know, based on whether they like end, I'm gonna get all the terms wrong because I'm so ignorant of music theory, but like when they end like an 8-bar sequence, if they don't bring it back to the same key, I think it's called, withholding tonic, because when you go back to the same key, it's very soothing. And if you don't, it sort of leaves you with this feeling of expectation or anxiety. So they talked about how, you can use that in songs to sort of create this sense of anticipation, you know, totally independent of whatever the lyrics happen to be. And he was at a piano and so he played a bunch of examples, and it was really, as an ignorant music person, it was really fascinating to me. So I think it was about an hour. I think it's worth the time for you to check it out.
Oh, I can't wait. It sounds fascinating. And I was actually, at the Tidal Wave used bookstore looking to actually buy an old copy of the Harmony Encyclopedia or the Harmony Illustrated Encyclopedia of Rock. And they had one from like 1985, maybe 86.
Wow.
Well, I didn't buy it though, because it doesn't have any of the Pete Frame family trees in it. And it wasn't, I mean, I think it was a version that I owned at one point, but I don't think it may have actually been the book I owned at one point, but I'm sure I have a more recent one that has those family trees and things that are a little bit, I think it's better illustrated to be an illustrated encyclopedia.
Yeah, I've got one. I think it's from the early 90s, either 91, 92. Got it when I was in high school, so.
Yeah, does it have the family trees in it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I'm sure, I hope it does, otherwise I'm talking about the different, entirely different book.
Yeah, if it doesn't, then I'm thinking about yours, which I'm sure I borrowed quite frequently.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know I've had a couple of versions of it, just because it was so interesting. And again, I'm somebody who likes to look through liner notes and find connections. I came late, way after you did, to the game of looking at, say, movies and saying, okay, this person directed this, so I want to see this movie. Or this person wrote the score for this, so he wrote the score for this too, so that may be interesting, you know, worth searching out. Well, I was doing that for music based on, you know, all the liner notes and stuff. Because, you know, you got to have something to look at sometimes when you're listening to music. And I didn't have a TV in my room for the longest period of my childhood. And so the Encyclopedia of Rock was awesome. I mean, just see how the progression of these musicians from band to band and sometimes genre to genre was really interesting. But anyway, it was just an interesting, I wish there was some website that made that easier as, like IMDb does for movies. Oh, but I know where I was going at the bookstore story. So I decided not to buy that book, but I was looking for any kind of like books about podcasting or even I was looking for like technical manuals on like music mixing and things. And none of that really, it was either way over my head, stuff that I will never do just to get this podcast on the air, or it didn't exist, or it was like super either old or not really informative. So I slid down further into looking at books about movies. And I ended up looking at a couple of what must have been textbooks about filmmaking or visual storytelling. And I realized that, you know, I don't really know anything about that either, except that I love movies. But now you can see all of these tropes or techniques, depending on how you're looking at it, of, you know, visual storytelling, like how you can tell stories. There definitely is. I mean, there is a reason why people go to school to learn these things.
Yeah, I think we'll probably touch on that a little bit as we talk about Man on Fire. I mean, there's certainly, yeah, there's a perspective. Well, we can talk about it once we get into the movie, but yes, I agree. It is very interesting and way more technical than. And then, you know, you would think at first glance, something I probably don't even have much of an appreciation for, but.
Oh, no, certainly. And well, I mean, for me, I certainly don't. And for the most part, I realized that even though I know a lot more about movies, having listened to a bunch of podcasts and now watching movies with a slightly different, with an agenda, because before I just let the movie take me where it took me and it was either good or bad and that was fine. I didn't really care too much about why I didn't like it. It was either, eh, or that was fun. But there really are interesting things that that directors do. And I don't know, maybe someday I'll come to appreciate Stanley Kubrick in a way I cannot right now.
Oh, that was another thing I was going to mention to you. You and Jason are thinking about doing Eyes Wide Shut at some point?
Well, no, not Jason. It was me and Diane at work.
Oh, that's right.
She loves that movie, and I don't think I saw it with you. I think I saw it with Sandy, but I remember there were a couple things I liked about it, but the overall, I thought it was a horrible movie.
There's a new book out about Tom Cruise, the career of Tom Cruise, and it's written by a woman who I think had a lot of access to not maybe Tom Cruise himself, but a lot of the people he's worked with. And I think she has a whole chapter on Eyes Wide Shut.
About like how everybody on that cast were so in love with Kubrick that they just do whatever he wanted?
Essentially, and how Cruise sort of approached that role.
Huh. Well, when I watch it again, I will search these things out. And I, you know, I have a better appreciation for Tom Cruise now than I did even at the time, I think.
Yeah. I mean, he's maybe one of the last remaining movie stars.
Oh, I don't know. There's a lot of people that are charismatic, maybe not quite as or in the same way. But yeah, maybe he's the, I don't know. Christopher Walken comes to mind. But again, he's a different generation.
He definitely seems like more of a kook.
More of a kook than Tom Cruise does? Tom Cruise seems pretty kooky.
Yeah, but he doesn't really, you know, except for, you know, a few very famous moments on Oprah, he doesn't really put himself out there in the public too much.
Oh, no. No, not at all. And so, he may when he gets older, too, like the way Christopher Walken is.
Yeah, I mean, Christopher Walken, you know, especially with his Saturday Night Live days, definitely had a sense of humor about himself.
Well, and there's a, I think, is it Praise You? I think it's Praise You, the Fatboy Slim song where Christopher Walken does the dancing. It's great. Excellent. Yeah, well, we'll definitely, I was talking, well, I think I texted you actually at the same time about running across that Stanley Son of Theodore and thinking about music and soundtracks. Although this particular movie, I don't, I didn't have any musical notes in, but I was really happy to talk about Stanley. And it brought me back to why I like music and like compilations of music and that kind of thing. Well, you heard it all, so you know.
Yeah, it was interesting to sort of transport myself back into that time when Jason was working at in the music department. Was that when the two of you were living together? Is that when you started to living in an apartment together?
Well, I think, no, he was working in payroll, I think, when although we lived together for quite a while. It was like three years or so, I think, maybe.
Yeah, like I think I was getting old enough where I was kind of not hanging out with the two of you as much, and you guys are hanging out more, and I was still in that place where I was trying to identify myself with what I didn't like based on what you guys liked. So, you know, you were talking about you were getting all these recommendations from Jason, and I, during that period of time, I think I pretty much summarily dismissed anything he recommended. Just so I could be different than him. But at the same time, when you guys started talking about those songs, you even, I think, mentioned Maren Cadell in passing. And that rang a bell, and I looked her up, and it turns out I know every single word of her Sweater song.
Oh, yeah. Maren Cadell is awesome. Yeah, I mean, that so Angel... Angel Food for Thought was a fantastic album, start to finish.
And yeah, just by being around you guys, I absorbed so much through osmosis. And even though I wasn't willing to admit at the time that I liked it, it certainly stuck with me.
Oh yeah, me too. From you guys as well. I mean, it went in all directions because you're around it, you can't help but. I mean, at least you have an opinion at some point, whether you don't like it or you do like it, at least it informs your worldview, I guess, especially since, you know, even though we were all different ages, we were all pretty young during that whole period. Mm-hmm. And that kind of stuff sticks with you. I don't, you know, there was somebody sent me something on Facebook about how music in your 20s sticks with you forever because just how your brain develops. So, and I'm sure it's the same thing for in your teens or whatever during different periods of your life. Plus, music is so identified with people and with experiences and things, so it's just all.
That was right. Nirvana was really the tipping point where I sort of had to get over myself and my music snobbery and admit that yeah, I could like the same stuff Jason did. Because we sort of came to Nirvana from different ways, but you know, when I found out he dug it and I dug it, you know, that changed my perspective a lot. That was also probably a year before one of my high school friends made me a tape of a live U2 concert in Zoo Europa. Yeah, and I mean, up until that point, because Jason really liked you too, and you did a little bit too, in the early stuff, you know, I decided I didn't like it. But just hearing that concert, it was just the quality was undeniable. So I just sort of had to revisit it and admit that, yes, it was really good.
Oh,
I liked it despite not wanting to.
No, but it's funny. It's your passion for U2 that brought me to U2. I mean, I had, Dan Brownfield had the War album, and, you know, that had Sunday Bloody Sunday on it and some other things. And that was great. I mean, that was, you know, it's hard to deny that was pretty great. And then, I think I had Joshua Tree that I got at like BMG Music. So it was like the, album that I got through the music club of all things. So I listened to it a couple times, I'm sure, but none of it really struck me. None of it really, like, lasted. It was like, yeah, this is fine. But whatever I got in that shipment of albums, something else was better as far as I was concerned. It's probably some sort of, Iron Maiden thing or whatever. I mean, at the time it's hard to tell, but you were so passionate about the Zoo Europa and the whole U2 thing that just like sucked me back into it. And then I became a big U2 fan for the most part. I mean, never quite as big as you or actually Jason, because Jason really loved the Achtung Baby album, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, but that was, of course, also happened to be the time that U2 really kind of exploded. I mean, they were always, or they had been since they began, something of a band to at least know about. But, you know, that's when they went on the big, huge tours with the big giant
lemon. That was the second, that was the Pop Mart tour.
Oh, okay.
So the Zoo TV tour was the first one with their giant television. And that album really sent me on a journey down bootleg.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
You know, I really enjoyed a lot of classic rock live albums. But that was sort of the first like contemporary, not really fit for commercial sales bootleg of that quality that I'd ever heard, and it was amazing. Just the difference, and they're really creative with their live music too. You know, they weren't like Queensryche, where they tried to be as album perfect as they possibly could live. So that was great. And so, yeah, after that, I always leaned towards trying to find imports and bootlegs of bands that I thought were cool, because if they couldn't perform live, then, you know, I just didn't think they were really worth the time.
Music is important, as it turns out.
Indeed.
Yeah. But, I don't know, so are movies. I like movies, too. And movies in music? I'm sorry, music in movies is a huge thing. Again, it's part of storytelling.
Yep.
Yeah. So
I'm ready.
You ready for Man on Fire?
I am.
Okay, so Man on Fire, Tony Scott, 2004. Tell me why we're watching this movie.
As it turns out, I really like Tony Scott movies. I like the style. I think I like him better than Ridley Scott. There's something about his sensibility that really speaks to me. I mean, these aren't, he doesn't make like super highbrow, like wannabe Oscar movies. You know, that I don't think they're pretentious, but they're really good, solid for the most part, action movies. And I watched Man on Fire when it first came out on video, because I thought it looked like a cool story. And it was one of the first ones that came to mind when you mentioned you wanted to start doing a podcast where you talked about movies, because when I watched Man on Fire, it really gave me this sort of throwback sense of what movies were like when you and I used to go to like 4 or 5 movies a week during the summer. And one of the movies we saw together was Crimson Tide, which is a pretty fun movie off of Tony Scott. So when I got done with Man on Fire the first time, I actually thought, like, this feel like a movie Eric and I would have watched back in the day and enjoyed. So I wanted you to watch it, and I wanted to chat about it so I could get your perspective on it.
Yeah, well, this is the first time I have seen it, and I liked it a lot. I was very happy to watch this movie. I was a little, you know, Tony Scott, and I don't know, you know, it's funny. I actually thought, well, I was with the first part of the movie, like the opening, there's a lot of quick, camera, quick cuts. There's also camera movement and stuff that I was like, is this gonna, the whole movie gonna be like this? Luckily, it's not. It's actually done for effect, and it's done pretty well. And immediately I thought, who did Tony Scott direct the remake of Get Carter? And he didn't. But that's what it looked like when the first part of the movie. I thought, well, wow, this is pretty stylish. And of course, you've got Denzel Washington and Christopher Walken, and so already you know you're in pretty good hands. But I was very happy to watch this movie, and this movie was, for pretty much being, yeah, like a popcorn movie, I thought there were some interesting things that he did in this movie. And this is dark, but it's not bleak. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's, I wouldn't go as, it's fully a redemption story, but you know, there is a little bit of that to it. At least it gives you enough hope to keep going.
Shall we dive into plot?
Yes.
Okay. So it's 2003, and we have an ex-CIA officer. This is, by the way, all plots are copied directly from Wikipedia. So in 2003, burnout ex-CIA officer and former Force Recon Marine officer John Creasy, played by Denzel Washington, looks for work and reunites with old friend and comrade Paul Rayburn, Christopher Walken, who runs a security firm in Mexico. Because of the extremely high rate of kidnappings in Mexico City for ransom money, businessman Samuel Ramos, Mark Anthony, hires Creasy through Rayburn to guard his 9-year-old daughter, Peeta, played by Dakota Fanning. Intending only to keep him online or on the payroll for long enough to renew his kidnapping and ransom insurance on the girl herself.
Right, and they're having money problems, so Ramos he can't afford somebody who's really good.
And his attorney, who is played by Mickey Rourke, is basically advising him that, you know, he needs to have the ransom insurance, and he just needs to satisfy whatever the insurance company, what their minimum requirements are for having a bodyguard. Because the whole thing is just to get enough time for him to get renewed, and then he can go about what he's doing before. And right. Is it clear why she hasn't been in school?
Yes. She hasn't been in school because her last bodyguard quit.
Okay.
And they were keeping her home until she got a new bodyguard.
Okay, all right.
And the last bodyguard quit because he got a better offer to go work for somebody else who paid him more.
Exactly, because Ramos can't afford to pay for the best.
Right.
And that's where Creasy comes in, because he is not the best. He may have a good background. His resume in killing folk is pretty good. But he's also an alcoholic who is has got some issues.
Yep, he's broken. He's your standard broken anti-hero.
So anyway, he comes into Ramos's employ, and he and Dakota Fanning have some nice little interactions.
But he had a great job interview with Ramos.
Listen, my wife wants someone presentable and polite. It'll be the fifth candidate she sees this week. Your resume is quite impressive. 16 years of military experience, extensive counterterrorism work. I'm surprised anybody could afford you. What's the catch?
I drink.
How does that affect you?
Cool. coordination, reaction time. If top professionals try to kidnap your daughter, I'll do the best I can, but the service will be on par with the pay.
What if amateurs try it?
Probably kill him.
He's very aware that he is broken and sort of at the end of his rope. And the only reason he took this job is because his buddy Rayburn told him he needed to do something with his life.
Yeah, he just sort of shows up on Rayburn's doorstep because he doesn't have any other place to go.
He starts asking the kind of deep questions Rayburn doesn't want to ponder, like, do you think God will forgive us for what we've done? Rayburn's like, no.
Yeah, well, and Christopher Walken as Rayburn just does such a great job. I know that there are some Christopher Walken roles that are way over the top, and I know that it's funny to do a Christopher Walken impression when people do it correctly, or actually when they do it well, let's say. There's no correct way, right? It's art. But he's just great, and he can deliver a nice little monologue, and he can act through expressions in a way that's very, it's very economical, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty great. I'm always happy to see him on screen. And Denzel Washington also does the same sort of thing. This is not a loud, boisterous character for the most part. This is a pretty quiet character. He's not quite Ghost Dog, but he's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, for Denzel Washington, he's pretty subdued.
Yeah. So, and then, of course, he actually, because he, Ramos is Mexican, and Ramos's wife, trophy wife, who is played by Rhoda Mitchell, who can't pull off her accent throughout the whole movie, which irritates me to no end.
It was so terrible.
Jason and I talked about Kingpin, and I think her name is Vanessa Angel, who plays the girl. Basically, she's just the girl. She's only one girl in the whole movie, really, except for Lynn Shay, who plays the landlord. And she can't carry her accent either. She's British, and she's supposed to be certain sort of Jersey person. Although there's no reason why she has to have such an accent. She could have been British in Kingpin. It would have been fine. Rhoda Mitchell probably, I don't know if she is Australian, New Zealand, South African, something. But yeah, I mean, I guess being American is kind of important. But really, she just had to be white to justify Dakota Fanning. That's all.
Right, yeah. She didn't need to be from the Deep South.
Yeah.
Or wherever she was.
Well, she's supposed to be from Texas because they're right on the El Paso Juarez. But still, it's, oh man. Anyway, it's like, I like her when I've seen her in things where she's good. Just come up, stay with an accent. I guess I find it particularly impressive when actors can pull off a really good accent, but it's really glaring when they can't. So I was a little bit irritated by that.
What did you think of Dakota Fanning?
You know, I thought Dakota Fanning was actually just fine. I mean, she was playing a spunky 9-year-old and she did okay. What did you think of Dakota Fanning?
I thought she was good in it. She seems like, I don't know why, and it's not fair. She just seems like she'd be annoying in real life. But she did well in this movie.
Okay, so plot-wise, we're establishing that Creasy's broken, and PETA, Dakota Fanning, you know, she likes going to school, so therefore she likes having the bodyguard, and she wants to be friends with him, and he is intent on not being friends with her because that's not his job. Because he doesn't have any kids, he doesn't have a wife, he doesn't, you know, the family thing. In fact, he has a suicide attempt early on in this movie.
After he really hurt her feelings by telling her that he's there to protect her and not be her friend, so she should shut up and stop talking to him.
Yeah, and I thought she did a good job, like, acting hurt also during that period of time. You know, I mean, her feelings were hurt, and I thought she did a good job portraying that.
Yeah, that was one big difference for me watching this movie this time around is the first time I saw it, I did not have kids. This time I do. And I've never been very kid friendly. So, you know, having your own changes your entire perspective on things. I certainly had a different feeling. I was very much more sympathetic to her this time around than I was the first time I watched it.
Well, and I mean, now that you have kids, you have skills you didn't have before. And you recognize signs that you would never have even noticed were indications of things to come as far as mood and things, so.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's, and so he did a good job turning somebody who has no kids and doesn't want any connections or whatever. Although, it doesn't beat you over the head with that too much. I mean, it's obviously, it spells it out. And when Rhoda Mitchell comes in and asks him about it, basically tries to tell him, you know, hey, you don't have kids, so let me clue you in on what it's like to be a real person around kids. And he's not interested in that conversation. He's like, you hired me to do a job. Being her friend is not the job you hired me for.
Yeah, but she, Dakota Fanning as Lupita, does a good job of sort of keeping after him. You know, he definitely is a project for her.
Yeah, you kind of can see that she is trying to run her own world.
Mm-hmm.
Like any 9-year-old will want to, I'm sure.
What I really appreciated about this movie is I thought it was really, really well paced. And it wasn't the same pace. I mean, it was certainly faster in some parts, and the beginning was much slower, but I thought it was well done. They spent the time they needed to in the beginning to set things up.
Yeah, and develop characters.
Right, because I don't think there's anything about this movie that was at all unpredictable. I mean, maybe something at the very end. I don't think you were ever really surprised or even supposed to be surprised about what was going to happen next.
Yeah, I don't think so either. They're not really breaking any new ground plot-wise.
No, but it was paced. So they spent enough time where they needed to and no more. And when they really needed to get stuff rolling, they just went for it.
This is a point where things start. And this is, by the way, this is a relatively long movie. I didn't realize what, you know, the length of movie I was quite getting into.
I didn't either.
It's
longer than I remember it.
Yeah, because it didn't feel long. It was fine. I mean, the length was fine because it was well paced. But it was probably, I mean, this, we are talking about 45 minutes of the movie that we're at now before the major action starts. And the major action is that while PETA is at a piano lesson, kidnappers come to take her. And they do. And Creasy is nearly killed by them. He kills a couple of them, but they fill him full of holes, and he nearly dies, and she has been kidnapped.
I mean, you knew it was coming. I mean, even if you didn't know anything about the movie, you had to know she was going to get kidnapped. Otherwise, there's no reason to have
the
movie.
Yeah, exactly. Now, when was the movie Proof of Life? I mean, I realize it's not fair to ask you that question because I don't know the answer, and I'm not expecting you to. But was this after that movie or before that movie? Do you think?
I would guess before.
Yeah, I don't know, because it seemed like they didn't go into any. I mean, obviously that movie was all about going into great detail on what happens during a kidnapping and attempt to get back someone who's been kidnapped.
Stunningly, Proof of Life was in 2000.
Okay, well, that makes sense then, because again, Proof of Life, even if you just saw the trailer, you had all the information you really needed to know to understand what happens after somebody's kidnapped, I think.
Right.
Because they didn't really go into a huge amount of detail about that part of it, because they trusted you to know what was going to be happening, and there was other stuff going on, because now that PETA has been kidnapped and her family is trying to pay ransom to get her back, That's all well and good, but because there were police involved in the kidnapping, they are trying to get Creasy for murdering and the policeman and probably being involved in the kidnapping.
The movie's a bit of a procedural, but not about the proceedings of kidnapping. I mean, it's a revenge procedural. So, you know, the kidnapping and the ransom, it's really just a speed bump to the second half of the movie. But you're right. They spend hardly no time on the logistics of trying to pay the ransom.
Which was just fine as far as I was concerned. You know, I kind of, at first I was irritated because they did this, it wasn't subtitling. The titles were right over the main part of the screen when they were speaking Spanish sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it started out with really, like, things you didn't have to have translated.
Yeah, this is one of the first movies I remember where Tony Scott was really creative with his subtitles.
Yeah, it was creative, but when it started out, I'm like, oh, this is not even necessary. But as it turns out, it worked, and it was fine. And a couple minutes into it, it didn't distract me from the rest of it that happened off and on during the movie.
Right.
And you had to have some subtitles in there because it was in Mexico and they were speaking Spanish a lot of the time. And part of his character is being a little bit of a fish out of water. Although, as it turns out, he spoke fluent Spanish, too, so... She's kidnapped, and there is this, like, kidnapping kingpin guy known as The Voice, who is the one who demands the ransom money, $10 million. And the lawyer, Mickey Rourke, arranges for the ransom money and works with the insurance company or whatever. Again, logistically, it's not really explained too much, at least at this point, about what's going on there. But the money drop is screwed up. They're ambushed by members of some sort of Mexican crime syndicate.
Yeah, so the drop goes bad. The kidnappers are pissed. The dude's nephew was killed. The Voice's nephew was killed at the drop. So he's mad. There's no more negotiating for him. He just calls back to tell the parents that their daughter is now dead. So they can start moving on with their life.
Of course, I mean, you could sort of see all this coming, but spoilers, because we'll be jumping ahead a little bit just to talk about this part of it. But when you first saw this movie, did you get the impression toward the end that she actually was dead?
You mean like the final couple scenes of the fantasy?
No, I don't. No, no, I'm sorry. No, I mean, it's revealed late in the movie that, oh, she's still alive. She's worth something and she wouldn't be worth anything dead. That's why I still have her. But for a great deal of the movie, for perhaps an hour of the movie, there is no Dakota Fanning because she has been killed as far as Creasy is concerned and the family.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. Yeah, I thought she was dead.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, me too. I thought, well, this really is like a revenge movie. He's going to kill everybody who was involved in her death. She is dead. She is not coming back.
Yeah, and he's wounded. He was shot pretty majorly wounded, and he developed such an affection for her that it's obvious he is going to die killing everybody because he starts his revenge quest before he's fully healed.
Oh yeah, and when it's
I had no thoughts that this was going to be a rescue movie. I just thought it was he's going to try and redeem himself by killing everybody he can, and probably I assumed he was going to kill the bad guy while being mortally wounded. That's how I predicted it was going to end.
Yeah, exactly. I figured he would be killing everybody in sort of order, you know, having Mickey Rourke, who, spoiler, turns out to be involved, and then The Voice being the final two people. And yeah, you're right, he'd be mortally wounded, and his dying breath would be, you know, carry on in my name, and then, you know. That was not this movie, thankfully.
Yeah, I mean, I would have been perfectly happy with that movie.
Well, yeah. But, and actually, there are some notes I put about things that I were happy that were not in this movie, that when I looked at IMDb later, were actually written into the first part of the script. At least that's what the IMDb says. So I was happy that they went the direction they did.
What were a couple of those things?
Well, the main one was I was so happy that Creasy didn't sleep with PETA's mom. Because, you know, in a lesser movie, that would have happened.
Right.
Turns out they filmed that scene. It was just on the cutting room floor.
Good decision.
Yeah. I was also happy that it didn't turn into Leon the Professional, where he ends up having an intimate relationship with PETA, because she's 9. That would be a problem. I think in the Scott Glenn movie, there's more of an issue there. But again, I haven't watched it, because the girl in the Scott Glenn movie in Italy is 12. Doesn't make it right.
Still not okay.
Yeah. Oh, no, not at all. Not in any way. Not in any way. So at this point, we have PETA dead, and we have Rayburn has rescued Creasy from the police, and now Creasy's on a mission to go and find out who's responsible and take them all out. In fact, he promises to Lisa, PETA's mother, Radha Mitchell, that he will kill them all. Or actually, yeah, he promises he'll kill them all. She actually repeats it to him, kill them all. And all I thought of was, isn't this what got us all into the kingdom in the first place?
Yeah, that really should have been such a cheesy moment, but yeah, it just worked.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, you know, if you at the very superficial level, if you put yourself in that position, you'd be like, oh, kill them all, absolutely. So I mean, I get it. It worked just fine. So, but yeah,
yeah. But if you were trying to act like a fancy Hollywood screenwriter, I don't know how you would type those words out with a straight face while sober.
Well, that may have been a problem.
Yeah, but,
oh, hey, tangent. Have you heard of the app called Hanks?
Yes.
Did you get the app called Hanks?
No, should I?
Oh, I don't know. I did. I haven't played with it yet, but I bought it. I thought, fine, I'll give him my money. But I thought of your name, was it NaNoWriMo project, that would be fun to type it out on Hanks.
That's the one that turns your iPhone keyboard into a typewriter?
Yeah, or ideally your iPad probably. Mm-hmm. But it gives you that, the sounds, I think, is what it's supposed to be, give you the immersive experience. Not just the visual, but the actual sound of a typewriter. So, might be fun. Or it might be just distracting.
Yeah, I don't even let my keyboard click on my phone or my iPad. I turn that off.
Yeah, it turns out, although I do still think my keyboard clicks are on, turns out people are really rabid about that too. Like, people will take your phone away from you and say, here, let me fix this for you, and turn off your keyboard clicks without even asking you. Which is why I don't give anybody my phone.
Yeah, no, nobody's taking my phone away from me.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so right now we are setting up this basically a revenge movie. And
another quick tangent. Have you ever seen the Kevin Costner movie Revenge?
I have not.
That was like on cable, or we had satellite back in the early 90s, like all the time. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a revenge movie starring Kevin Costner.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I mean, that's kind of, sometimes that's what you want.
Yeah, no, I watched it probably 4 or 5 times just because it was imminently watchable, even though it wasn't a great movie. Turns out, Tony Scott.
Oh, there you go. At some point, I think I want to revisit one of the Death Wish movies. But I'm a little frightened, so we'll see. Maybe I'll find a different Charles Bronson movie. Because there's a Charles Bronson, Jack Palance movie that's that's pretty cool too, around that same period of time. There's a lot of, like, you know, late 70s, early 80s revenge movies.
Did you see the Kevin Bacon version?
No. Kevin Bacon did a remake of Death Wish?
They didn't call it Death Wish. It wasn't necessarily a remake of the movie, as I understand it. I haven't seen it. But it was based on the same source material, which I believe was a book.
Oh, okay. Well, it's funny because the source material for this Man on Fire is kind of what the 1987 was supposed to be based on, in that it took place in Italy instead of in Mexico. The reason why, because I think the source material in this book was written in the early 80s, and Tony Scott had just done The Hunger, which at some point we will have to talk about. But apparently The Hunger didn't go over very well, so he wanted to direct this movie next, but had to shelve it. And so somebody got the rights to it and made the Scott Glenn movie. And at the time, it took place in Italy because kidnappings in Italy were a huge deal. But then flash forward, 15, 17 years, and it was Mexico that was the hotspot of kidnapping. What is setting up to be, in fact, Rayburn takes Creasy to buy a whole bunch of supplies, including a rocket launcher. Or I guess what's single-use rocket-propelled grenade, something like that. That's, I think we're setting up that kind of movie. But then we're introduced, this is where they become more major characters. The familiar faces of Rachel Ticotin and Giancarlo Giannini.
So she was from Total Recall, right?
Yep, and Con Air, among others. And he was Rene Mathis from Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. As well as being, a serious Italian actor.
I think he was gutted by Hannibal in Hannibal, right?
He might have been, yeah. Yeah, he's been in a lot of things. But yeah, I was happy to see her. I was happy to see him. And they play, Rachel Ticotin plays an investigative journalist in Mexico, which is always a kind of a sexy role because, that's journalists end up dead in Mexico. And he plays an agent of the AFI, which is basically the FBI in Mexico. And they have a little thing going, or he's a ladies' man, and she's willing to sleep with him for information or whatever. They have a relationship that pops up here and there to get information from one to the other.
Yes, they are both very interested in taking down the voice.
Exactly.
And he is also interested in taking down the La Hermandad, the crime syndicate, who he believes is mostly made up of corrupt cops.
Yes.
Yeah, and she is the type of reporter who can magically find out any information anywhere about anything super quickly.
Yeah, the scene where he calls her on the phone when she's sitting at the computer and she just writes down two names and says, "I'm on it."
There were a couple of those scenes. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially in, the first name was the Mickey Rourke character, which actually is a pretty unique name. Mm-hmm. But the second name, the one where he wants to trace the credit cards and stuff, that's a pretty common name, I want you to look at this guy named Charles Jackson. Can you look at the phone history for a Charles Jackson? Oh yeah, okay, you bet. Anyway, so yes, it was a little convenient.
Very convenient, but I didn't care because at this point the movie takes off and it goes full steam ahead. It does not. It never looks back, never thinks too hard.
Oh, no, and it ratchets things up pretty quickly, too. I mean, as far as it keeps that tension or the momentum going for quite a while. And then, and this is going to be a part of the, this is the part of the podcast where I skip major important things and you have to go back and explain them for me, and then I tried to edit it to make it sound better. But,
my favorite part.
But so we're trying eventually to get to the voice, although again, we're following Creasy pretty much, so he is just going up the ladder. And he has already found out pretty much early on that he suspects both parents are involved, and it turns out Mark Anthony admits that he was involved. And he gives him the opportunity to commit suicide, which Mark Anthony takes.
It was with the same bullet, right?
Yeah. So it was like an element of chance, I guess. Because the bullet that didn't fire for him, you know, it could just be a dud.
Yeah. You mentioned Creasy's suicide attempt earlier, but he actually put the gun to his head and pulled the trigger. And for some reason, it didn't fire. And he pulls out the bullet and he looks at it. And there's an indention where the hammer struck the primer. And there's no good explanation for why the bullet didn't go off. But he kept that bullet around.
And in that part of the movie, he's talking about the Bible a lot. And she goes to a Catholic school. So he's talking to the nun in charge. So this could have gone down a strange mystical path.
Well, this is the sequel to this movie is Book of Eli, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, I was worried that the sequel to this movie was going to be Leaving Las Vegas.
Did I ever tell you my Leaving Las Vegas story?
No, go ahead.
My buddy Ron.
No, tell.
So this has a fun tangent, but this has two elements of. From our last podcast together, The Apartment, it has a movie that is much less lighthearted than you expect, and it has a moment where I am very comfortable with other people's discomfort. It was the summer, the first summer that I came back from college, so it was still close enough to high school that I was. I was in contact with most of my high school buddies. So when we were all back in town together, we kind of all reconnected and hung out quite a bit. One of my buddies, who had been dating his high school girlfriend for, I think, 3 years in high school and their first year in college, they got back to the summer after doing a long distance thing for freshman year, and she dumped him. And so he was pretty bummed out. He didn't want to leave the house much. So one night we were just like, okay, look, yeah, we don't have to go out and do anything, but you got to come over to one of our houses. We're going to drag you to a video store. You're going to pick out a movie and we're just going to hang out and watch it and get your mind off things. So he was all mopey. He was like, all right. So the best part was we go to the movie and we tell him to pick out whatever he wants to watch. We'll watch it and we won't bitch. So their breakup really was like a divorce where they had to kind of split their friends. So there were those of us who remained his friend, and then she had a bunch of their friends that landed in her camp. Well, it turns out we all decided we were going to go to that same video store at the same time. So he ran into his new ex with all of his ex-friends, and we're standing there, and it's super awkward, and everybody's just kind of staring, and everybody just looked like they wanted to leave. But I was really digging it. I thought it was hilarious. So since no one was saying anything, I actually said something like, "This is tremendously awkward. We should go." And we did. You know, he went out and picked out a movie. And someone explained to me later that they thought I was a giant asshole for pointing out how awkward it was.
That seems a little bit of harsh criticism, but oh well.
Yeah. Well, I might be. I might have a fuzzy filter on what I actually said. It's my history.
Yeah.
So the movie he picked out was Leaving Las Vegas.
Of course he did.
Yeah, which I think I'd seen with you. I was like, really? You want this? He's like, yeah, this is the kind of movie I need right now. I was like, really? All right.
Had he seen it before?
Nope.
Okay, so clearly he did not know what he needed.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, we just went along with it. And so we went back to our other friend's house and we watched it. And I'm not exaggerating. He actually, like, watched the whole thing, like, while hugging a pillow. And, like, the further along in the movie we got, the more of his face he was hiding with the pillow. And on it, I think it was finally, like, after the scene where Elizabeth Shue had been sodomized by the frat guys. And he was finally like, what the fuck? We're like, what? You picked out this movie? he's like, yeah, where are the flying Elvises?
Oh, yes. Yes, like, yes, yes.
Oh, sorry, buddy. That's a different Nick Cage Las Vegas movie. He's like, that's the movie I wanted to watch.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, that is so funny. I mean, in not super funny. And
I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah.
He's doing fine. He's happily married now.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I was going to say, we should change his name if he's not doing fine. That would not be great to... Yeah.
Sorry, that's my giant tangent.
No, that's fine. That's awesome. So anyway, here's the first thing that surprised me about the end of this movie. So we narrow down Creasy...
Wait, this ahead. Is the part where I tell you skipped past something important.
Okay, go ahead.
So right when Creasy starts his quest, there's a great monologue by Rayburn. I think he's talking to the AFI guy, right?
Yes, a very good monologue.
Where the AFI guy is just trying to figure out who this Creasy guy is. And Rayburn in like the best Christopher Walken.
This is my jurisdiction. I want this man as much as Creasy does.
He'll deliver more justice in a weekend than 10 years of your courts and tribunals. Just stay out of his way.
I plan to. I will even help him if I can. But I'd like to understand him. Give me that.
Peter Ramos. It's a number to you, you know. One more dead, but a number.
What was she to Crazy then?
She showed him it was all right to live again.
Who took that away, huh?
And they're gonna wish they never touched a hair on her head. A man can be an artist.
And anything, fool, whatever. It depends on how good he is at it.
Creasy's art is dead. He's about to paint his masterpiece.
You know, Kevin Pollak does a great Christopher Walken, and Jay Moore does a great Christopher Walken. But you know who the best Christopher Walken is? Christopher Walken. I mean, because these are some... It's a cheesy line.
Yeah.
But his delivery is so great. That you're like, you know, and he has a little, like, little thing at the end he does with his face. It's like, just to punctuate it. Like, this is just what I'm telling you, and, you know, this is, you know. Of course, you know, on the podcast, me making the face doesn't help anybody at all, so.
There was kind of a shoulder shrug made mostly with a facial expression.
Yeah, I mean, you know. Christopher Walken's speech in Pulp Fiction about the watch is fantastic, but this is just a mini version of that in like two sentences that gives you the same feeling without the hilarity.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Creasy ends up going and killing these guys in some creative and some just sort of blunt force ways. The most creative of which, by the way, I thought was when he, of course, I forget who the guy was. Was he a police guy?
Oh, he's the head of the kidnapping unit for the Mexico City Police.
Yeah, there you go. Also involved in the whole thing.
Also the head of La Hermandad, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, he kidnaps him from his motorcade using the rocket propelled grenade, and the next it cuts to him underneath a highway overpass with the guy sort of facing down, spread eagle over the hood of the car, and explains to him that in his rectum he has some plastic explosives, and there's a fairly crude timer, and it will go off in 5 minutes if he doesn't spill who is involved in the kidnappings. And it's a scene that when he starts explaining, it's like, oh, this is pretty unpleasant. And the way the victim of this, or the bad guy, and Creasy's conversation together actually really works really well. And of course, at the end, the bomb goes off because Creasy's not fucking around.
No, again, it's a moment that should be really cheesy. It's the slow walk away with no reaction when there's a giant explosion behind you.
Oh yeah, it should be. It should absolutely be totally cheesy, but it's not. Like Denzel Washington, he's a good actor. And like I said, the guy who plays the police chief guy, he starts off being, you know, okay, I'm not going to tell you anything. Probably isn't even a bomb. You're going to let me go. You know, he conveys all of this, you know, pretty much with gestures and facial contortions, really. But by the end, he shows actual serious fear. And, you know, and that's when Denzel Washington just cold walks off and boom. Which, by the way, here's the other thing I was happy that didn't happen that was actually in the original script. I thought at the end of this movie, Denzel Washington would have his own rectum bomb.
Oh, no.
Yes. I thought that
was in the script?
Yes. When we get to the end, I'll explain how that was going to work out. But I seriously thought, oh, well, this could be possible. I mean, you know.
Was that how he was supposed to get the voice?
Yes. So, anyway, so now you have, and so you, now you know what kind of movie you're dealing with as far as he is really, really taking this thing seriously, this revenge thing seriously. He is now pissing off lots and lots and lots of people and getting closer to the voice.
Yeah, he's working his way up the chain. They don't spend a lot of time. The first couple interrogations and killings, they spend a little bit more time with. But each one is different. Each one's creative. It's good movie making. And then they definitely kick into overdrive.
Yeah. That's, I would say so. So he ends up, through some stuff we don't even have to really talk about as far as the credit cards and stuff. He ends up putting together, that the voice is actually involved with the lawyer, and B, they finally actually have an identity of the voice so he can try to go and hunt this guy down. Well, in what was a shock to me, he doesn't actually kill Mickey Rourke.
No, he doesn't.
No. Oh, I jumped ahead a little bit and told to you that Mark D'Anthony killed himself, but really, he kills himself at this part of the movie after we find out that he actually killed Mickey Rourke.
Right, yeah. You know, I guess in retrospect, there's no other reason to have this character played by Mark Anthony unless he turns out to be a bad guy. And I guess not even like a villainous bad guy, but just a pathetic, stupid bad guy.
Yeah. And, you know, he gets what's coming to him, so that's satisfying. And he ends up taking out Mickey Rourke without Denzel Washington having to, which I thought was a fine choice. Not entirely expected.
Nope. And move things along.
Yep. So then, Now we get to toward the end of the movie where we're going after the voice directly. And so he ends up going, Creasy ends up going to this slum area to look for the voice's family. And he finds the voice's brother and the voice's pregnant wife and some kids.
Right.
And in probably the most brutal scene in an action movie I've seen in recent memory, at least, he takes a shotgun and blows pretty much most of the fingers off of the brother in order to force, I guess, the exchange.
Right. I thought that was actually reminiscent of RoboCop.
I can see that. At this point, the voice...
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Besides screaming when his fingers are shot off with a shotgun, does the brother ever say a single thing?
I do not believe so.
I mean, he threatened the reporter right before that, right?
Yes.
That was him. But in any scene with Creasy, he never actually speaks, right?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, because he's wounded from the get-go by Creasy.
And terrified.
Yes. And knows things aren't going to go very well for him.
Right, because everybody knows who Creasy is at this point.
Yeah. And now, so over the phone, Creasy is making these demands, and then he wants basically to meet with the voice so he can kill the voice. And he says to the voice, I'm going to kill all your family until I can finally come to you. And the voice says, well, hold on. Why don't I trade you a life for a life? You for the girl. And this is when you find out that PETA is really still alive. There was actually a scene earlier where he busts into a nightclub, and for a moment you think maybe that PETA is going to be a kidnapped person at the nightclub, but it turns out to be a different girl who he ends up rescuing. So at that point, I figure, oh no, she's actually dead.
Yeah, and then thinking back, there's also that bit of foreshadowing where there's that flash of her waiting on the curb.
Yeah.
She's not actually there.
Well, I didn't think that was so much foreshadowing as just him, like, dealing with the ghost of her.
Right.
Yeah, but...
But it was a visual reminder that, she's still an important character.
Oh, yeah, no, still in the story. I get it. I can see that. So, he's going to make the exchange, and it ends up being exchange the brother and Creasy for the girl. And I wasn't sure how it kind of got to that point. Like, did it seem like pretty quick that it was all of a sudden he was doubling down on the amount of people he wanted?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, as soon as the voice, I think he could tell what it meant to Creasy that the girl was still alive.
So
it wasn't just that, it wasn't like a Ronin situation where his master had been killed, so he was duty-bound to seek revenge. Which it could have been. You know, he might have just been that ticked off that, you know, the girl he was protecting was kidnapped and killed, and then he was shot. I think it was during this conversation where the voice realized that the reason he's on this quest is because the girl ended up meaning so much to him.
And so he figures he can find a way out, and here's the way out.
It was actually right after the voice found out that she called her teddy bear Creasy Bear, right?
Yeah, because he doesn't believe that she's alive. He's like, give me proof of life. And he's trying to think of something, and he has her diary, the 9-year-old's diary. And so he's like, what does she call her bear, her stuffed bear? So that's the proof of life, and it's all very, very touching and sad. So, and he is, by the way, quite wounded at this point. And still, I mean, he's still recovering.
Was he shot by the brother when he was entering the apartment?
Yeah, I think the brother shot him.
Yeah, it happened really fast, though, I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that he was shot. And so he is already sort of dead man walking, we think. He and Radha Mitchell and the brother go out on one side of a bridge, and the voices men on the other side of the bridge with PETA. And they have this scene where PETA goes across the bridge and they hug and have a moment. And then Creasy walks across the bridge and surrenders himself to the voices guys.
It was actually a really long moment with PETA. And yeah, this is where I was really impressed with Dakota Fanning. I mean, it was a little much, but they definitely spent some time showing how affected she was by the circumstances. I think she did a good job of going through the whole range of being terrified, being relieved, being terrified again, and then being heartbroken about what was happening to Creasy.
And I thought the end where he basically, they don't show what happens. Well, I don't know. Does he presumably die in the car of natural causes?
Oh, he dies of his wound.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Because he drops the necklace.
Exactly, the St. Jude necklace.
Mm-hmm.
But originally in the script, he is driven to the voice's house, and he and the voice have this conversation about the value of a human life, and all the while he's looking at his watch. And then when he's asked why he's looking at his watch, he just smiles, and then the whole house blows up. So
that sounds terrible.
Yeah, I'm happy that didn't happen. That was horrible. So, in a nice little ending, like epilogue kind of ending, they have his name and his birth and death dates, and then it flashes to the scene of Giancarlo killing the voice during the raid on his place.
So that was in cold blood, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it seemed like he was surrendering by the pool. How much do you know about the cast of the 1987 film set in Italy?
Nothing beyond Scott Glenn as Creasy.
Oh, well then let me enlighten you, okay? Scott Glenn is Creasy. I like Scott Glenn a lot. It's great. He'd be great. The Rayburn character? None other than Joe Pesci. The leader of the mafia, Danny Aiello.
Of course.
Yeah. Brooke Adams plays the girl's mom.
I don't know who that is.
She was in The Dead Zone. She played Johnny's girlfriend. Short hair, brunette.
Nope.
Ah, okay. Well, and that's all. Those are all the names that I recognize. But anyway. Thought you might appreciate
some other Scott Glenn revenge movies. Probably.
Yeah, probably. You know, the Scott Glenn, Joe Pesci buddy films. So Man on Fire, I was happy that I watched it.
Excellent. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And I think it still
held up watching it again.
Well, the way you explained it, as far as like a movie that we would have gone to back in the day, I think that's how I received it. You know? I mean, I thought it was fun. It wasn't too over the top, but it had some things to it. It had some, you know, had lots of good acting. It had, it was just a well done movie.
Yeah. I was genuinely sad at the end.
Yeah.
With Creasy dying.
Yep. Yeah. It was a sad movie, but he was a tragic character from the beginning. So it worked story wise. I mean,
yeah, and what really got me thinking while I was watching this movie is sort of comparing it and contrasting it to The Frozen Ground. Another movie that I think we both agree wasn't bad, but wasn't great. But specifically made me put them together in my mind was both of them were pretty procedural heavy. You got to go point A, point B, point C, all the way to get to point D. They were going to hit those beats, and it was predictable. But the difference is, Frozen Ground, it was obviously somebody who was new to their craft and didn't quite know how to pace the movie, how to shoot the movie to keep it interesting, even when maybe the story beats necessarily interesting. And I thought Man of Fire was the complete opposite of that. It was very stylized. It was very deliberately paced differently in different parts of the story. It was creative with the visuals, you know, all the way down to the subtitles with weird dissolves. So this was sort of someone who has mastered his craft doing a similar type of movie, but the difference and how enjoyable it was is just incredible.
I think well said. That's yeah. I don't have anything to add to it. That's great. And the level of acting, they could have done this sort of thing with John Cusack, certainly, and probably Nicolas Cage.
Mm-hmm.
But they just, it wasn't there for them. And maybe it's, you know, first-time director, maybe it's editing, maybe it's the amount of production time that they had to shoot with. You know, there's, I guess, a lot of excuses can be made, but you're right. This is a guy who used all of his considerable skills to get the story told in a way that was... Even the author liked it.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Plus, the one thing that they mentioned is that part of the reason the author liked it is because they mentioned, like, they actually use words from the original book. I guess it was a novel. They actually use... lines from the novel in the movie, which always impresses writers.
Why not? It's already written.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And I guess the scene between Dakota Fanning and Denzel Washington where she accuses him of smiling was all like an ad-lib thing, which is pretty cool. I mean, it adds heart to the whole thing.
That's funny. So were they like trying not to break character then?
I think so. Yeah.
Like the Almost Famous take, right?
I don't know about the Almost Famous take. Or I have forgotten.
It depends how. I'd actually like to do that movie on the podcast at some point.
Yeah, me too.
Then we'll talk about it when we get there.
Okay, cool. So anything else on Man of Fire? Man on Fire, sorry. Man of Fire is a whole different movie.
Why is it called Man on Fire?
Okay. I don't know. Tell me.
No, that's a real question.
Nah, I don't know. He's full of rage. It's a revenge movie.
I guess.
Here's a thought. Here's a question rather, not a thought. But, I guess maybe I already know the answer, but why, when I look at posters or cover art for this movie, half the time Denzel Washington has a gun in his hand and the other half it's the same picture without the gun in his hand. Is that simply because audiences like at Walmart don't want to see a picture with the gun in his hand?
Maybe.
I mean, you think if you were offended by the gun in his hand, you wouldn't be watching the movie anyway, because he shoots a rocket propelled grenade at somebody. Nope, that's it. That's all I have for about Man on Fire.
All right.
Thoughts
on... What are we doing next
week? Let's see.
Whatever you want to do.
What do you think of Casablanca?
That's fine.
Yeah, let's do that. I haven't seen it in a bit, and I remember liking it quite a bit.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. I will then, if not before next week, or next time, we'll talk then. Yeah, your walkout lines for Man on Fire?
I wish you had more time.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Anyway, thanks again. This is a good movie. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.